Attention, New Yorkers making under $80,000 a year. There will soon be a new rental building with you in mind. While the world was obsessed with the Middle East, Japan, and Wisconsin, and we'll get back to the Middle East and union rights later in the show, see if you can hold out, New York City was quietly negotiating a silver lining to the housing bust. A luxury condo project that failed in Brooklyn will now be built as affordable rental housing. It took arm twisting and a taxpayer subsidy, but it sets what could be an important precedent in the city's ongoing affordable housing shortage. Here to explain and pop a virtual champagne cork, perhaps, are Rafael Sestero, the city's commissioner for housing development and preservation, and city council speaker Christine Quinn. And fair warning to the speaker, we will also see if she is as livid as Mayor Bloomberg about the state budget agreement. Welcome back, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And listeners, we'll open the phones. As many of you know, we've been covering this halted development issue for 2 years. So let's keep at it. If you know a failed condo project that could be ripe for conversion to affordable housing, call in and tell the speaker and the housing commissioner. This is direct access for you, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post it to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. Speaker Quinn, tell us what's happening in Prospect Lefferts Gardens.
Well, this is very exciting. 2 years ago in my State of the City address, I announced a program we're calling HARP, the Housing Asset Renewal Program. And the idea was to take these things that were, by all accounts, negatives in our neighborhoods, buildings that had gone up in the boom years. They were going to be luxury or market rate co-ops or condos, and they were just stalled. They weren't done, or maybe they were done, and they were empty. To take these lemons and make them lemonade and figure out how we could convert them into housing for middle-class New Yorkers that would be permanently affordable. So we worked hand-in-glove with a task force we had in the Council of Experts and with HPD and came up with this idea where basically we say to the owners, you take a loss, you write down your price. The city adds in a subsidy. We further take down the price. We restructure there the finances of the building, and we make the building either a rental or a middle-class ownership building. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's exciting, in addition to taking eyesores and making them homes, this program per unit is costing us less than it costs us on average to create a new affordable unit through HPD.
That's great. Commissioner, the speaker said this is middle-class housing. Who will be eligible?
So the program is really designed for moderate and middle-income New Yorkers. The building that we closed on last week will be affordable for families earning between 80 and 100% of area median income. To give you a sense of that, depending on family size, that's anywhere from $50,000 a year to $79,000 a year for a family of four. So it's a, you know, it's a program that is designed to serve middle class New Yorkers who are the ones that really are struggling very hard to find affordable housing, and who often are make just a little bit too much money,
right,
to qualify for our existing program.
And a lot, and this is an important group to assist, because a lot of the federal programs for housing, which are terrific, target low-income New Yorkers. And we need that housing, but we have far fewer federal options in funding for moderate and middle-income folks. So this was really a very, if I do say so myself, creative way to fill a gap in the city's housing model. And I believe we are the first city in the country to do something like this. And we're having other cities now call HPD to say, hey, tell us about this model. We want to do it.
Interesting. We have stalled construction developments, too, right, elsewhere
right.
around
That's
the country.
Right.
They
right.
certainly do. You didn't get a call from Las Vegas yet, did you?
not from Las Vegas, 60,000 but from a few other cities.
Yeah.
But on the subsidy, it took a $3 million tax subsidy to get this deal done. Is that the right number?
I think in total that's the right number. Yeah. What we did was we doubled the number of units in the building by reconfiguring them. So that was a positive thing. And I think it ended up being about $64,000
right.
per unit. We had a kind of a cap of about $75,000 per unit, which is less than the HPD average, but we came in at 64, so we were also glad about that, and glad that we were able to double the units as opposed to those usually thought of.
$64,000 per unit, that's a lot of months' rent equivalent. Why in these hard times is it worth every other taxpayer in the city subsidizing 46 middle-class families' rent?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One, having stalled buildings on a block is terrible for a block. They're a blight. They are not – no activity occurs in those buildings. Often the sidewalks aren't shoveled. The lights aren't on, so you eliminate a blight. Two, providing housing for New Yorkers of diverse income is something that it is appropriate to use taxpayer money for, because that is absolutely in the overall good of the city. And to start in Brooklyn, our biggest borough, a place with huge housing needs, is exactly the kind of thing you want to do with taxpayer money.
Commissioner, we've been talking about this idea on the show for 2 years, as you know. We even had our listeners crowdsource what we call a halted development map, placing Google Map pushpins on the stalled condo construction projects in their neighborhoods. But this is the first time a developer bit. Why did it take so long?
So I think it's a couple of things, Brian. First of all, you know, in New York, we love to tout ourselves as being on the cutting edge of everything. And this is a case where I think we absolutely were on the cutting edge. And we were on the cutting edge because we have a Speaker of the City Council who is as forward-thinking and as innovative as Christine Quinn. And we're very lucky in New York to have elected officials who were thinking a year or two down the road. So the Speaker put this task force together and saw the crisis coming. You know, the truth of the matter is the crisis didn't really hit New York at the same time it hit the rest of the country. So this program was put together.
It hit us a little slower, a little later.
That's right, a little slower, a little later. So that's part of it. The second reason is that, you know, we've had a very low interest rate environment for the last couple of years, and that's allowed lenders on these stalled sites to continue to service the interest that's owed on their construction loans and hope that the market will come back, because that's the other part of it for New York. It, not only did it hit a little slower and a little later, but it never got as bad as it did in Las Vegas, as you mentioned. And I think that is part of the reason why it's taken longer than some people might have thought it would have taken to get these projects off the ground. But I think, you know, we've got a robust pipeline now. We have more projects in the pipeline than we have money in the budget. So we're going to have to work on figuring that out. And I think now's the time in which we're going to start seeing these projects come to life. And it's really going to make a huge difference in neighborhoods all over the city.
New York City Housing Development and Preservation Commissioner Rafael Sestero, New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, as we talk about their program to get luxury condos that failed to transform into affordable housing. The first one has now been announced in the Prospect Lefferts Garden section of Brooklyn. And some people are calling in with some other stalled development projects that they would like to nominate. I don't know if this just comes from walking around the neighborhood and seeing the eyesores, or if they're, you know, they've got inside knowledge. But let's hear from a couple of folks at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Mark in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How you doing? What you got?
Well, I live in Williamsburg, which is probably the most overdeveloped neighborhood in the city. And actually right on South 4th Street and Bedford Avenue, Bedford Avenue is kind of the hot spot street, there is a stalled development that is there where they don't have, you know, it's very incomplete. There's not windows covering many of the floors, and you can see that it's really starting to deteriorate, especially with last winter. It's been that way for probably about 2 years now. And it definitely is an eyesore, but I'm also worried about, you know, just it crumbling down and never actually being taken care of.
Thank you for calling with that. You're familiar with that intersection, Commissioner?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, obviously, Williamsburg, as the caller pointed out, was one of the neighborhoods where the building boom took root and continued. There's a number of projects that we have looked at over the course of the last couple of years in the general Williamsburg area. And obviously, it's a target for this kind of program.
Michael in East Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Good morning, Brian. Good to be on your show. I live in East Harlem, and there's a block, then 115 between First and Pleasant. It's by rails, and actually, it's next to the Mount Carmel Catholic Church. You'll see a sliver about six stories high. It's a cubist design. And it's been vacant and unfinished for 3 years now. Not only is it vacant and unfinished, but the sidewalk is rough and unsafe.
Thank you for pointing that out. This is just the kind of thing that I think you want to know. Not only is the building vacant and underutilized, but there are even potential hazards there.
Absolutely. And we want to know about these buildings for the housing program, but also we have some other programs and laws in place around requirements for keeping the sidewalks and the quality of life issues around stalled sites up to what they should be. So we also can follow up in both of these locations from that other perspective of whether the owners should be fined or have violations because their sidewalks are in disrepair.
I've read that you're negotiating on four other sites, which could mean 200 more affordable apartments, according to the Wall Street Journal. Is that the right number?
Yeah, that is. We have four sites that we've tentatively approved through our internal process at HPD and are in negotiations with the lenders on those sites. We've got another five sites that have submitted applications to us that we're reviewing right now. So we have, you know, we have a robust pipeline of projects across the city. And as I said before, I think this is really the time that this program is going to take hold and really, you know, have real positive impacts in neighborhoods across the city.
And I think April in Manhattan, as a possible tenant who might covet an affordable housing unit, has a relevant question. Hi, April.
Well, actually, I'm apartment poor. I have a very swanky Central Park West apartment that I'm going to pay to go into the nursing home. But my comment is, why always the middle class? Why not the poor? You know, African Americans were targeted by subprime mortgage companies. There are all sorts, on the Upper West Side, there are all sorts of empty, fancy condos and co-ops that aren't a danger to the community because they're just fortresses, sort of. And
right, but I get your question, which is why is this middle class housing? Why not target housing for the poor, which might be even in shorter supply?
Well, we do a lot of the city's overall affordable housing program targets low-income New Yorkers. Kind of as I said before, the vast majority of the federal money we get, which is very, very significant, is targeted to low-income New Yorkers. So the place in the pipeline where we have a hole or a break is really around moderate and middle, and we wanted to fill that. But trust me, the vast majority of what HPD does is around low-income.
More than 70% of all the units that we create or preserve under the mayor's new housing marketplace plan, 112,000 units have started construction since 2004. More than 70% of those are targeted to low-income families and individuals. So, you know, we're trying to fill that gap. In addition, New York City is the largest provider of federal Section 8 housing vouchers in the country. Between HPD and New York City Housing Authority, we provide over 130,000 vouchers to residents of our city.
With respect to this program, is it also that if you're trying to convert what we're going to be luxury condos for the most part, then they're in relatively better neighborhoods and they're not low-income housing neighborhoods, but maybe they'd be middle-income housing neighborhood? You're shaking your head
not so much.
No,
not necessarily. I mean, I'm an advocate of having diverse income neighborhoods, and I think it's a benefit when you develop housing
that is a good idea. Mixed income.
But
rare enough in this world.
Right. So, and a lot of the neighborhoods where this development went up were neighborhoods with different incomes. So, not necessarily that.
You know, before the bubble burst, Commissioner, we used to talk all the time on this show about how unaffordable and downright crazy the cost of housing was in New York. And it still is, really. But maybe, unless you're a developer or a homeowner about to sell, this bust is a greater good than evil if it makes living in New York more affordable. Is that an insane notion?
You know, I think anytime you go through an economic crisis, I don't think you could ever sort of say that, you know, it was an overall good thing. There are, you know, 10% of our population is unemployed in certain neighborhoods. That percentage is much higher. So I would never say that the economic downturn that we've been through has been a good thing.
Of course. But in terms of housing prices deflating.
At the same time, right, I think the point you're making is true, which is that prices are coming down, in particular in outer borough neighborhoods. And yes, you know, that may be bad for a certain group of people, but overall, you know, it does have an a positive effect on overall affordability. On the other hand, let's face it, even that impact really is not affordable for a family of four making $65,000 a year. There's
right.
a long way to go before that happens, and that's why we need these kinds of programs, and that's why we need to continue to advocate and push for affordable housing in our city, which you know we're very lucky to have people like the speaker to do.
Ruth in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. The question is this. Why are buildings that were affordable housing condominiums or Michelama condominium allowed to convert to market price for the people to make a profit and to reduce completely the supply of affordable housing?
It's really a great question in the context of this conversation, Speaker Quinn, because here you are, you know, trying like crazy to turn market rate luxury housing into affordable housing, but there's also this sieve by which policy is allowing affordable housing to convert to market rate.
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason, Ruth, is because when these programs, Michelama and et cetera, were created decades ago, they were created to make affordable housing that existed for 20 or 30 years. So they were structured in a way that they got developers to do the housing with the kind of carrot that you got to convert in 30 years. That's why the HARP program we're talking about today is permanent housing. It doesn't have that option. There is no conversion potential in this, and that is something we learned from the mistakes of the past. Now, one of the other things we're doing in the council right now with NYU is creating a database where we're going to be able to track all the Michelamas and other programs so we know ahead of time when they might be able to opt out, if you will, so we can start organizing against them. But, Ruth, you're right. It was a mistake in the old housing models, and it's something we are trying not to replicate.
We have a few more minutes with New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn and Housing Preservation and Development Commissioner for the city, Rafael Sestero, talking about this plan to turn failed luxury condo developments into affordable housing. A couple of things for each of you before you go.
You know,
off
this, Brian,
topic.
This is Raphael's last interview as HPD commissioner. Friday's his last day.
You had to out me.
I do have an exit question for you a minute. So I'll leave you in suspense just for the moment. But, Commissioner, we're going to be talking about Forest City Ratner's plan later in the show to build prefabricated modular buildings, an apartment tower at the Atlantic Yard site. In a recent article by Charles Bagley of the New York Times, who will be on next hour, he writes that you declined Mr. Ratner's recent request for an additional $10 million in subsidies to build low- and middle-income housing in the site. That would be in addition to the $14 million HBD already approved for the site, I believe. Why did you decline that request, and is there any reason to recalculate the amount of public subsidies granted for affordable housing at Atlantic Yards if Ratner decides to cut his construction costs in half, as apparently he's trying to decide to do by going prefab?
So so a couple things on that. One is, you know, we have a set of programs that we use across the city. We start the construction or preservation of some 14,000 units every single year at HPD, along with our sister agency, HDC, that fall within certain subsidy parameters that make sense for taxpayers and make sense for the city. We felt that the additional subsidy that Forest City was requesting for the tower, the first tower in Atlantic Yards, didn't meet those parameters, and frankly, that we felt like was not a good public investment to go beyond what we have already committed. We want to see housing built there. We're all deeply committed to seeing not just the arena built, but to see the housing built, the affordable housing built that we've all been working so hard on. But we think that the parameters that we've laid out, the program that we've laid out, allows that project to go forward.
But the specific question is, if his costs are now going to be cheaper to develop housing than were originally expected, would you withdraw some public subsidy?
We would evaluate it at the right time. I mean, our subsidy numbers are constantly evaluated in any deal that we're negotiating right up until the moment we close. And if costs come down and we're able to shift resources, then we'll do that. But we'll make that evaluation at the time. And at this point, we don't have specific numbers on Tower 2 in the Forest City plan to make that determination.
Now, Speaker Quinn, before you go, as threatened, I want to get your reaction, reaction to the state budget agreed to in Albany over the weekend. The state budget, of course, affects the city budget. Mayor Bloomberg is acting livid about restoration of only $250 million in school aid rather than $600 million he says he expected. I assume you and the mayor are on the same page about this?
Well, you know, I think overall it's good in the long term for the city that the state gets its budget under control. So I really want to applaud the governor for kind of finally taking the bull by the horns here and saying we have to change things because, you know, that in the long term is a big problem for us in the city, having the state out of whack, so to speak. We in the council had been pushing for restorations very aggressively in Albany. Some of those we got. We're very happy that the Title 20 funds got back in. That means we will not have to close 100 senior centers. And I want to thank all the seniors who helped us with that. I'm disappointed we didn't get more money. I had hoped we would have gotten more money around education. That number is less than what we had pushed for.
4,600 teacher layoffs. Do you think that's going to be real?
You know, I'm going to do everything I can with my colleagues between now and July to try to prevent layoffs of city workers. That's something you want to avoid. If there are workers out there who are duplicative or you don't need, that's a different scenario. But obviously, we're going to do what we can to, as hard as we can, to keep core services. And one can only argue that teachers are core services.
And Commissioner, Friday's the last day for you on this job?
Yeah, that's right, Brian. It's been a remarkable journey. I've enjoyed every minute of it.
And you've had a good reputation with, I think it's fair to say, developers and affordable housing advocates alike. But I understand you're going to take a job with a developer, L&M Development Partners. Should I be disappointed that the revolving door is still turning between government and one of the most powerful special interests in the state, the real estate industry?
You know, Brian, I've worked in affordable housing my entire 22-year career. I've been deeply committed to it through both stints in the nonprofit private sector as well as in government. I'm going to go do something new. You know, L&M Development Partners is one of, if not the most respected developer of affordable housing in our city. They are a true double bottom line company. And one of the things that makes our system in New York great, one of the things that allows us to produce as much housing as we do, is that we've got strong nonprofit and for-profit partners that work with those of us in government to get that agenda done.
And Brian, I just want to say, I can't imagine anything Raphael would ever do would be a disappointment to anybody. He has been an amazing commissioner, and he's a really terrific person.
Commissioner Sestero, Speaker Quinn, thank you both so much for coming in. Brian Lehrer and WNYC, still to come this hour, we will meet Neil Barofsky, the Inspector General of the beloved TAR program. And I don't know if he'd like this comparison or not, but I think if you like Elizabeth Warren, you're going to like this guy. And then we'll ask if college basketball players should share in the money that some schools reap from March Madness. Stay with us.